Hello, teachers and learners from near and far. Welcome to Inside Education, your recommended weekly requirement of professional development on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm Sean Delaney, and podcasts of hundreds of previous episodes can be downloaded from my website, seandelaney.com. My guest on the programme this week is Dr. David Powell from the University of Huddersfield, where he is the director of the Education and Training Consortium. David Powell has a background in the further education sector and began his teaching career as a lecturer in travel and tourism, and subsequently moved into staff development and then teacher education, where he has been working since 2005. I met David at the annual conference of the Association for Teacher Education in Europe, which was held in Gävle in Sweden in late August. One presentation given by David at the conference was titled Searching for the Soul of Teacher Education in Europe. So when we spoke, I began our conversation by asking David Powell what the phrase the soul of teacher education means.
Yesterday when we were talking about it, people were saying, is soul the right word actually? You know, so you might recall that somebody said in the session about heart and whether that was a better term. But here I'm borrowing from Zeichner and Bill Green's work. And I think there are three things perhaps. In essence, it's who we are, what we do, and the relationships with the people we work with, whether those are our students, our colleagues, and our partnerships. I mean, Green talks about it being the everyday work of teacher educators, their students in the school systems. But I find that Stephen Ball's work also on the soul of the teacher, which of course I think that's where it's come from, is a useful starting point. It's about our identity, how that identity might be shaped by previous experiences, and also, you know, those relatings, you know, that Stephen Kemys would talk about, you know, that shape us really and make us who we are. That is where my thinking is today. I tweeted something last night, and a colleague who I used to work with called Kay Sirebottom mentioned the idea of rhizome. I think she's thinking about Deleuze and Guattari's work, really, about our connectedness as well, and how the rhizome works in the ground and finds ways of growing and connecting.
So. Because another aspect of soul is very often soul is used in a religious context, whereas heart is not so much. And it seems quite ironic that as religion is kind of becoming less of a presence maybe in Western culture, that now some existing researchers in the area are talking about the soul of teachers or the soul of teacher education.
Religion and spirituality are two separate things. Now, I haven't looked at it, but my other great friend and colleague, Joel Petrie, has been doing some work. He's a further education-based teacher in England. And he's just sent me a paper that he presented at the Further Education Research Conference, where he's been playing with religious metaphors as well. Now, religion often sets out rules and is very prescriptive. Whereas if you talk about spirituality, then that is more open-minded, thoughtful, and I might say sometimes perhaps doesn't always follow the rules of religion. So yeah, and I can see why people might be sensitive to it. But for the time being, I want to stick with it, because maybe it is, you know, whatever it is, it's a deep question. And it's the essence goes down. I think Green talks about animus as well, the essence of who we are.
And it's also used in relation to teachers. So who we are, what we do, and who we relate to.
The original work, I mean, one of my great colleagues, Kevin Orr, who's a professor of work-based learning at Huddersfield. When I told him I was coming to talk here, he said, when I mentioned about the soul of teacher education, he just talked about Stephen Ball's work, which was linked to the issue of performativity and managerialism. You know, what does it mean to be? I think it's transferable. I think what Green and Zeichner are doing is have borrowed it and are trying to develop it, you know, to apply it to a particular type of teacher, the teacher educator, who works in teacher education, which is a particular field of teaching.
And your own country is England and the UK. Yeah. So what shapes the soul of teacher education there?
The question I asked yesterday really was thinking the external factors that shape it. We are particularly shaped by league tables. And you've got two types of league table, haven't you? You've got the international league tables. You know, how come the Finns are above us? You know, hey, look, we can beat them at football. Why can't we beat them in education? You know, I mean, we have a problem with football in England, you know, particularly these small nations beating us, you know. So you've got that. But also, we are preoccupied with league tables in our own education system. So everything's about ranking, isn't it? You know, if you combine that with the policy technologies, as Borg called them, of education reform, so managerialism, performativity, those league tables are used to manage people. And for instance, for teacher education in England, teacher education is inspected by Ofsted.
Which is the Department of Education Inspectorate, right?
Well, yeah, it's the Inspectorate. It's a quasi-autonomous national government office which is given the duty to inspect the quality of teaching by institutions, whether it's a school, a primary setting, early years, secondary, further education, college or university. So they come in and they judge the quality. And unless you are good or outstanding, then the future of teacher education or a school is in jeopardy. So can you imagine that? The pressure, you know, of that on somebody, the turmoil that would cause for somebody, you know, how do I navigate my way? So you've got that. You've also got the curriculum. And I used the phrase yesterday from Rob Loy and Tedder, the factorised curriculum, where it's very precise. It says they need to know this. They need to know that.
They being teachers.
The learners, the students.
Students in classes.
The students, okay. That's right. So they have to know this, this knowledge, and we're going to give you this long to teach it, and we're going to fund you in this way. So these drivers, really, the resources, the external factors, which of course judged, they're all enmeshed around, or they surround the soul, don't they? And they put pressure on us. So, you know, how long have I got for this? How long have I got for that? And what they have driven quite often is this idea. You'll have heard about teaching to the test, the product, learning by rote, whatever. And I think there are two other ideas that I think are real, the essence as well of shaping it. The first is this phrase essentialism, which I think is very powerful, which is, what is this subject? You know, what is teacher education? And the fact that they've produced a set of standards for teachers means that is translated into a curriculum, a factorised curriculum. And the belief that, you know, when you're inspected, the inspectors come and say, how are you doing this? How are you doing that? For instance, I mean, this is a very powerful, you may be familiar with the Preventer agenda, Sean, which is a response to the, you know, issues of security, really. And for instance, particularly some of the bombings that we've had, the threat of terrorism. So there's a requirement to teach British values. That's been a priority, but also prevent, you know, and those are now inspected. So the inspectors come and tell us, how do you teach that? And that's actually a lot of pressure. So you've got that essentialism, you know, this is what you've got to teach. So it's factorised. We're going to assess it in these ways. And then the other phrase that I thought was very powerful from Bill Green's book, you know, chapter, salvationism. You know, by doing this, we will all be saved. Religious language as well. And I think that has to be, you know, the idea in particular in England about apprenticeships. You may have heard about the apprenticeships. You know, we're going to have a model of people will learn to teach through the apprenticeship model. If that saves us, fantastic.
That's the teach first approach, is
it? Well, that's not the apprenticeship. That's another idea of salvationism. So teach first is where graduates who've got two ones or firsts come into teaching for a short period of time and then leave. You know, like the SAS of teaching. Special mission, you're out, you know. No, the apprenticeship model, it takes the view that it's very practicum based, so the new teacher is based in the school, they're taken under the wing of an experienced mentor, and they learn how to teach in the school with perhaps some day release. It's almost like an in-service model with some day release to maybe a university, or it may be done by the school, where they pick up the knowledge, whatever we decide that is, to teach and supports that.
And if we go back again to the soul of teacher education, if I want to see that, where do I look?
Listen to what they say. what Stephen Comis would call the sayings, doings and relatings. Listen to what they say, watch what they do, watch how they behave and how they relate to people.
And to what extent do you, or to what extent would you, make that explicit to your student teachers about the soul of their work and about the soul of their students?
That starts really at the very beginning for people to think about, what does it mean to teach? You know, asking that question, what does it mean to teach and be a teacher? I haven't asked it yet in this context within the soul, but I might ask it now because this is quite new for me. I mean, the Green and the Zeitner work only came out last year. So, I mean, Boards was 2003, so it's been slushing around the system for a while. But, I mean, I know a colleague once, Heather Booth Martin, when we talked together, we asked the students, what is your mission statement? What's your purpose? You know, what do you get out of bed in the morning to do as a teacher?
What kind of sustenance can you give to develop it or to...
Well, I mentioned modelling, isn't it? And I think what you're trying to do is, you're not trying to get people to copy you. What you're trying to is reach out to them and say, how can you leave your, you know, a really positive footprint on this world? And I want you to think about what I say. And you don't have to do everything I say, but I want you to find something in what I say and to think about how you can use that. So you're trying to get them to be alert, emotionally alert, you know, have that emotional awareness of who they are, what their purpose is, and then turn that on, you know, like an internal GPS system, they check it out. You have to reach out to all your teachers, and you've got to think about, how do I communicate with them? And it's not always in the same way, is it? You know, sometimes it might be getting alongside them after a session, lesson observation. It might be, you know, when they've done a piece of work or something like that, you know.
And at a time in society when many of our student teachers are themselves looking for meaning and looking for a purpose, where can they look for such a purpose that in the past might have been provided by religion but probably is less so today? And for some it still is, but it's probably less so today. So where do they look? I mean, do they look to, you know, great books? Do they look to great thinkers? Where?
A long time ago, and I read somewhere that each day we paint a picture. And I think if we can hold on to that and think, you know, I'm just going to try and do the best picture I can today, okay? And to think about that and to stand back and look at it. As, you know, whether you're Turner, Van Gogh, you know, have a look at it and think, okay, that's my piece for today, you know, and tomorrow I'm going to do something which is going to slightly different colour. And I think that to get them to feel that they are creating something that is lasting, that hopefully people will have value and will inspire them in the same way. You know, that's what artists do, isn't it? You know, great musicians, you know, Miles Davis and things like that, you know. It's a delicate balance here about performance. But actually to see that everything you do is significant and that actually fundamentally you've got to reach inside that person who wants to be a teacher and find out what is it that makes them that teacher and connect and just to help them feed it. To feed it and recognise that sometimes in life there are barren periods too. They have to go back and find out what it is that made them want to teach. I was thinking about the film about Turner the painter. I don't know if you saw it.
No, I didn't see it.
Well, it's worth bothering with. Some good teaching messages in there. And one of those is, and I never knew this, that when people used to have exhibitions in Turner's time, the painters hung their paintings a day or two before the exhibition started for viewing, and then there was like these last minute adjustments. What he did is Turner went up to somebody else's painting and he was looking at it and he just went like that. He just adjusted or smudged the painting and came away. That's fine. And he walked off. And I think when I produce a session plan, I'm imagining in my head a painting for my students. You know, and sometimes I'm just adjusting it, you know, and I step back and then I come back. So, you know, I'm always thinking, you know, what might this painting look like? How much colour is it going to have? What style might it be in?
One of the stories you mentioned in your talk yesterday, in your presentation yesterday, was The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Yeah. So first of all, could I ask you, I'm going to ask you, you know, why you chose that story. Yeah. But for people who might not be familiar with the story, could you give a brief overview of it?
I'll tell you what my memory is of it and sort of link it. But I think the first question is, you know, why did I use it? Well, I've been reading Jerry Chernovinsky's book about teacher educators in the 21st century, and he mentions it. And it took me back, you know, to when I was probably, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8, and my grandmother would take me to the cinema. And I remember going to see this film, and it's really towards the end, really, isn't it? You know, where this sort of mop becomes, you know, wants to try and imitate the sorcerer, you know, the wizard. And so they, through a process of magic, they can sort of temporarily become the sorcerer. But the problem is they don't know how to be the sorcerer. They've become something, but actually they don't know what it means to be that. And so actually the apprentice gets themselves in a lot of trouble. And all I remember when watching it with my grandmother is that, you know, they got faster and faster and faster with the buckets of water trying to fill this pail, and then water was everywhere and it was just chaotic. And I just thought, quite quickly I saw that I could see a link there with the danger of some of the teacher initiatives, this quick fix to create teachers within a year, 2 years or whatever, you know, that are going to be, you know, to what extent have they really understood those skills, knowledge, behaviours that we're expecting them to learn, so that, you know, in, you know, the fierce storms of the classroom, you know, the a tough group, a long term, whatever, they're actually just go back and say, yeah, I remember how to do this, you know. Because, of course, in the Sorcerer's Apprentices, it just ends up as a big mess, doesn't it, you know. So that's what I remember, and I think somebody, you know, mentioned yesterday about using a wand or whatever.
When I told somebody last night, David, that I was going to be interviewing you today, they said, make sure to ask him about the viewing frame. Okay. So what is the viewing frame?
The starting point, going back to the world of art, is David Hockney. Hockney says, learning to draw is learning to look. And during my thesis, working with these teacher educators, we were talking about how do we help the student teachers to look in the modelling? Because you can't all the time explicitly model, but you have to teach people how to look and notice what's going on. It's not something that is just picked up through osmosis. So if Tom Russell, the teacher educator in Canada, he invited his student teachers in to watch him teach. And what he found at the end of the discussions were that, at the end of the class, the discussions were not as rich as he expected. And he wondered why. Because they hadn't been taught to observe. They hadn't been taught how to observe him. Now, in England, observation carries a very particular meaning. It's about quality. We're not talking about quality here. We're talking about observation as a way of learning, noticing, that discipline of noticing that Mason talks about, noticing what somebody does, how they do it, and then, in the spirit of John Lofgren and Amanda Berry, asking the teacher educator, maybe from time to time, because I've made some notes, you know, Sean, I just noticed you did that. Have you got a moment to explain what you did and actually why you did it? Because it's interesting, you know, to help me to understand it. You know, so much of teaching might be described as seamless know-how, you know, effortless know-how indeed. And so together with the teacher educators and some teacher educators in the Netherlands, some in Poland, some in Israel, and some in England, but working in universities, so we had primary, secondary and further education settings, we tried to use this viewing frame as a tool for supporting the skill of looking, to start a dialogue between the teacher educators and the student teachers, so that the students were noticing, and Hogg, who's here, she was, one of her pieces of work, she was talking about the students, you know, there is so much for the student teacher to watch in a class. They're not just watching what you're doing, they're trying to think about what the theories might be doing, and this, the idea of the viewing frame is, in a sense, a cognitive dumping ground for ideas. So you make notes as you see it, and then you try to pause at key points in a session. You don't do it every time, but you've got to develop the skill early on in the programme. Then once it's acquired, you know, then it becomes more naturalized as part of the class. But early on, you're trying to teach that skill, and it needs to be practiced. And in fact, Eisner, I think, talks about epistemic seeing, you know, knowledge that is acquired through the eyes. And that is that, that's the idea behind the viewing frame. So it works along the idea, it's time-based and activity-based, so it's sequential in terms of the class. So the teacher educator would plan, think and imagine what I want to model. Then I identify the phases in the class that we're going to unpack, okay? And, you know, build extra time in to do this, okay? And then enact it. And across, there are four columns. And the first column, it literally asks the very simple question, because actually looking is very complicated, as Hockney would tell you. You start off with the simple question, what is David doing? What is he saying? What's he doing? Who's he saying to? How's he saying it? So, you know, and then you get them to notice that. Then the next column, the second column, and you would never use more than one column at a time. It's too much cognitive load. Okay. The second column, it asks, what are the ideas behind David's decisions? Then the third column is about how might I apply what David's doing to my own teaching? That application, you know, the approximation. And the final one is the theories. What are the theories behind? And you work your way through as the program. I mean, that's the feedback we got. You work your way through the, you know, the program. You move between the columns depending on what you aspect or pedagogical element you want to unpack with your student teachers. It's, you know, it's quite powerful. Still fairly early on in its development, and I need to do some more work with it. You know, more of a longitudinal study, really.
And what kind of duration of teaching would you look at in a typical excerpt? Yeah.
Well, I think you can only ask them to watch for maybe 5 minutes at the most. So normally, I would start off, at the start of the academic year, I want them to watch me start the class. So actually, when they might arrive in the class, I might have them, you know, it's just a message, just says, watch what I'm doing, okay? Make a note of what I'm doing. We'll discuss that later when the class starts. And so, you know, what you're trying to do is to teach them to build those phases of the class. And I would say that they can watch for 5 minutes or so, you know, and it's very tiring that. And then we unpack it, and that could take 20 minutes.
Going through the four stages?
Well, no, you just focus on one stage. And the first one is, what is David doing, or what has David done?
And that's for 20 minutes.
We would unpack it. So, you know, if I was moving around, you know, I might have said, what was I doing? Who was I talking to? Why was I doing that? And sometimes I invite the students then to take the position of the teacher. Come and stand here now. Come and look what's in front of me. What have I got in front of me? Let's hold it up for everybody to see, because you can't see it. And we unpack it gradually, you know, so that they start to see into the seamless know-how of the teacher, educator or the teacher.
Does it matter whether it's observed live or on video?
I don't think it matters. The main point is that it's discussed. And the value of videoing is that actually they can rewatch it, notice what they missed, and go back again. And that was one of the sort of suggestions, you know, to rewatch. But I mean, you've got to be careful, Sean. You know, here's David's viewing frame. We've seen it so many times this year. You know, you've got to just think about what... I mean, use the phrase diet, you know. I mean, I'm loving the fish here, you know. But hey, I'm going to have to go on to something else, you know. You've got to think about that, you know. And it is really about imagining what a good teacher education programme looks like and how, you know, that might support those student teachers. Not everybody wants to be filmed. In my study, there were two teacher educators who didn't want to be filmed. But I respected that, and we invited them to join the teacher talk meetings. So they were still involved in the study, but they weren't being filmed. But I could then write up, and they know, you know, we talked about vulnerability. To film yourself is a big thing. For me, it's the soul of being a teacher educator is being vulnerable and working with it.
You say you spend 20 minutes working on the first column of the first pillar of the frame. When would you then go through the other stages for that clip or for that piece of video teaching? No,
I think you need to, you've got to recognise where they are. They're starting off, you know, maybe if we were to think of it in an academic year, the first column, what is this, what is David doing? You would use in the first 6 to 8 weeks because they've got no theory at that stage. No, not a lot of theory. And actually, they might not be in practicum yet. And until they're in practicum, you can't really be saying, how are you going to use this? Unless they're already there. So those two will come later once they're in practicum. I think once they are comfortable and you know they are noticing, and you know that through the feedback, then you can start moving on to the explicit, you know, the modelling. Okay, you know, what have I been doing? How have I been doing it? You know, and you know, what options maybe I had in that at that moment in time? You know, for them to realise, in the same way that the Sorcerer's Apprentices, you have to make decisions sometimes in the moment, and you know, you live with those decisions, but the student teacher needs to understand why you made that decision and you didn't use their decision. And I think that introduces that complexity and it gives people, you shows you've got autonomy in the classroom. It models professional judgment, autonomy. And also, I mean, I always give my student teachers a copy of my lesson plan. Always. They have to see in another way. Even if I wasn't using the viewing frame, there's... See where David is now, and we maybe stop it. Okay, what time is it? Oh, it's 25 to 1. So where should we be on the lesson plan? Oh, right, David. Where are we actually in the lesson? Okay, so how's that happened, and what am I going to do next? And interestingly, just bringing this back, last year I had a senior manager came in. I went to one of my partner colleges to do this with the student teachers. And one of the senior managers sat in the session and he said, you know, David, what I really liked was the fact that you showed them that they could go off the lesson plan. So many student teachers, we're 25 to 1, I've got to do this. I'm going to have to speak extra faster. And it's like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. I've got to speak faster, 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 faster. Oh, water everywhere.
And that message about not slavishly sticking to a lesson plan came from David Powell from the University of Huddersfield, and it brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I met up with David Powell at the annual conference of the Association for Teacher Education in Europe, in Gävle in Sweden. You can listen back to this programme or hundreds of others on seandelaney.com/podcasts. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from online bookstores or directly from Routledge. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.